LLAM is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, welcoming the English Concert with violinist Andrew Manzi for a concert of Baroque music, and the St. Petersburg Philharmonic with conductor Yuri Timurkanov and pianist Ivo Pugarelich. For more information, contact the Krannert Center ticket office at 217-333-6280 or visit krannertcenter.com. Support for today's broadcast is provided by World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 14 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of cheeses, olive oil, balsamic vinegar, spices, chocolates, cookies, and more. Catering services are also available. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
And we hope you will support public radio. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. This is our fall membership drive. It is underway. We're midway through. With your help, we'll meet our listener support goal of $140,000 by week's end. We have another goal to hear from 500 new and re-enrolling members. We're on our way to the goal of $140,000. And today's goal, by the end of the day today, we hope to have hit the $75,000 mark. In Pledge Center, where we have volunteers and phones ready to take your telephone calls, your pledges of financial support. Ring them in at 217-244-9455. That's 244-WILL. They're in Pledge Central with the volunteers, with the telephones. Maeve Riley, she's the editor of our program guide, Patterns. Maeve, how are we doing?
Well, we're doing okay. It's a little bit slow right now. We'd like to get the phones ringing. We're at about $66,215 on our way to that $75,000 goal for today that you mentioned. So get to the phone now. Give us a call, 217-244-9455.
And we've got a great interview coming up with writer Robert Olin Butler, and we won't interrupt that interview. So right now is a great time to get to a telephone and make that call with a pledge of financial support. 217-244-9455. You value this service? Help support it. Give us a call right now. The basic membership, $40 a year. The number to call, 217-244-9455. Maeve, run us through the process here. If a call comes in, what happens?
Well, a call just came in, and the volunteer is answering that, and it'll just take about a minute or two of your time. They'll ask if you'd like to make that on a credit card or if you'd like to get a packet sent in the mail to you. There are a couple gifts available. If you make a pledge at the $75 level or above, you can get the stainless steel travel mug. And if you put it on a credit card, you can get a Whimper map, which is a Where is My Public Radio Station map that you can take with you as you travel around the country. Just takes a minute and you'll be on your way. Know that you've done a good job, and then you can sit back and listen to the interview.
Very good. Thanks, Maeve. And we'll check in back with Maeve and folks in Pledge Central later in this hour, but we won't interrupt the interview. So please, if you haven't yet joined the Friends of WILL, give us a call at 217-244-9455. And to those of you who have called this week, thank you very much. Again, the number 244-WILL. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Writer Robert Olin Butler is our guest this afternoon. His latest book is a collection of short stories inspired by the picture postcard. The title, Had a Good Time, Stories from American Postcards. The book contains stories and illustrations, the postcards that inspired the stories. There are also news clippings here, but I wonder if they're really news clippings or not. We'll talk about that as well this afternoon. Robert Olin Butler collects postcards from the early 20th century. He seems most interested in the messages written on these cards. One of the postcards included in this collection of stories is a photograph of a young woman sitting, her hands clasped around one knee. Her expression is one of sadness. Her eyes do not meet the camera. A caption under the photo reads, "Heartbroken." The message on the back to Mr. Carl Peterson says, "We'll meet in death." No signature. Listeners, I invite you to join our discussion this afternoon. I look forward to your questions and comments. The phone numbers to join the discussion in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Robert Olin Butler is the author of 13 books. His most recent novel is Fair Warning. He was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 1993 for A Good Scent from a Strange Mountain. He teaches creative writing at Florida State University. His new book, Had a Good Time, Stories from American Postcard, is published by Grove Press. This evening, October 20th, he'll be at Pages for All Ages bookstore in Savoy for a reading and book signing. That event set for 7:30 this evening. Pages is located just south of Champaign on Route 45 in the Savoy Plaza. Then tomorrow, for those of you in the Chicago area, he'll be at Barber's Bookstore on South Halstead, and that is set for 7:30 p.m. Thursday, October 21st, 1218 South Halstead. If you'd like to join the conversation this afternoon, give us a phone call, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Good afternoon. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
It's a delight to be here. Thank you.
How did you begin collecting postcards?
Well, I guess it probably began in my childhood when I collected baseball cards. My beloved St. Louis Cardinals. I'm an Illinois boy from Granite City. When I grew up and returned to collecting, I certainly had an interest in paper ephemera. And so I started collecting old advertising and trade cards. But those boxes of postcards always sitting near the trade cards began to talk to me. And then I looked at them, and most postcard collectors collect simply for the images on the front. But I quickly learned to turn them over. And so for the last 14 years or so, I've been collecting picture postcards, as you mentioned earlier, for those messages written on the backs, those little outbursts of thoughts or feelings from people who've long since passed away. These are quite old cards. The 15 stories in Had a Good Time were all written between 1906 and 1917. I found this was the most fruitful period for the messages written on backs because it was when the postcard fad was at a very intense sort of peak, but it was also the two decades before the phone was common. So that passing impulse to communicate something, facilitated, by the way, by the fact that in those first two decades of the 20th century, almost every town and city in this country had at least two mail deliveries a day. So you could – I found often clearly people were just communicating – you could – across town, you could write a postcard to a friend in the morning and receive a reply in the afternoon. The phones came along and those passing impulses disappeared into the ether. Interestingly enough, and indeed, the postcard was the first two decades of the 20th century equivalent of email.
Right.
Now we've come back. A lot of people rail against email. But at least we're back to writing to each other, at least.
On a daily, sometimes
more than that. Yes, exactly. Well, that was the function. And sometimes, as I said, I found extraordinary outbursts of feeling. The card you read at the beginning, interestingly enough, at first I read just what you said and noticed just what you said. And by the way, the woman on the front is not the writer. It's a mass-produced card. Some of these are called photo postcards,
yeah,
which are taken by
all
people
right
with their Brownie cameras and printed. But that was a mass-produced card. It is not her, and it's a printed word, heartbroken. So all I had to work with was Mr. Carl Peterson, Attleboro, Massachusetts, and We'll Meet in Death. Indeed, the card was probably intended, and this is how I first read it, to be bought by somebody who was had been insulted by a friend or – I mean, there are a lot of nuanced categories of cards that were printed back then. But – and I thought when I read it, oh, that was a tough breakup. But then if you look more closely at the address, it's Mr. Carl Peterson, care of the Attleboro Sanitarium in Attleboro, Massachusetts. The man was dying of tuberculosis. And suddenly, what a complex relationship those four words suggested. As you mentioned, there was no names, either his name in the text or her name. No, darling, I love you, or I'll miss you, or I can't bear this, or whatever. It's simply, we'll meet in death. And so I've then paired that card. This in life, they were not paired. It's the one story in the book. And as you mentioned, these are all reproduced, the cards front and back in the book. It's the one story in the book that I use two cards. That is the card that she comes to write in the story. Mm-hmm. At the beginning of the story, I put another card, which they've featured on the cover of the book. Mm-hmm. And again, there's an interesting disconnect between the image and the message. Just as that heartbroken was meant for a breakup of a relationship, this card is an image of a pair of lovers sitting on a bench looking out to sea, and they're under a parasol, and the parasol, you can see through it. And you see the lovers about to kiss, and the printed caption there was, "I can quite see through it now." But the message written on the back is, "Dearest sweetheart, a line or two, hoping they will find you all in good health. As for me, I am getting worse. I don't think I will live long enough to see your dear face again." Mm. And so I put those two cards together. That's Carl writing to her in the way
Carl
I have arranged it.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And it's Mrs. Carl Peterson, mm-hmm. that is.
In the story. Yes. In life, those were two separate cards.
Right.
Two separate deaths.
Right. But you get to do that.
Mm, sure. You asked earlier about those newspaper mm-hmm. items. The stories are laid into the book in a very conscious way. There's a gestalt in this book. But there was a story I knew, a postcard that I knew would be the last story. And it is one of those real photo postcards. And it's taken from a kind of height, presumably on a lifeguard stand. It's looking down into the water, and there I tried to count them once, and it's hard to count, but there are at least 120 people in those old-fashioned one-piece bathing suits standing up to their waist in water. And they're all beaming these glorious smiles up at the camera. And the caption in the back, somebody has simply written, "Sunday, August 7th, 1910. And somehow that whole group, because the book is a portrait of America, and I had 200 or 300 terrific postcard backs cards to choose from, but I chose 15 to represent all the regions of the country and all the themes that were on people's minds, mm-hmm. and I split the gender 7-8 in the 15 stories. This group photo seemed to me to be a kind of summing up thing. And so I knew I became interested in what those folks sat on that beach and read that day. What were the things going on in the world the day before that was on their minds when they read that? So I sought out and bought 7 newspapers from that day. So I have authentic newspapers, one of which, the Times, is what the narrator of that story reads on the beach. The other 6 papers, I took absolutely authentic items from those newspapers, mm-hmm. except the very last item in the book, I made that up as a kind of summing up of the story that was written. But all of the other items, every one of them is absolutely real, including, and show you the sort of synchronicity of this, the New York Herald of that day had an editorial
yes.
on picture right. postcards.
That's something I want to ask you about. Now, the news item, the fictional news item mm-hmm. that ends the book is dated August 8th.
Yes.
One day later.
Exactly. So all of the August 7th news okay. items are actually authentic.
Okay. Let's go and talk about this editorial that mm-hmm. appeared in the New York Tribune, Sunday, August 7th, 1910. Very interesting observation about this new thing, mm-hmm. the picture postcard.
The picture
it is
postcard.
In vogue. And this editorial asks, is it the picture itself or the contracted space it leaves for writing that gives the picture postcard its vogue?
Mm.
For you, it's both of those things coming together, I think.
Yeah, the interaction of them, but more
the message?
Contracted space. Yeah, it's those people. And of course, most people did not have a direct enough connection between their heart and their fingertips to really reveal something. This was a labor-intensive hobby. As I say, I have probably nearly 300 cards where the messages are really terrific, and I could find stories in them. But for every one of those, I read 500 cards or 600 cards where, you know, I had a good time or wish you were here, or I have a head cold, or why aren't you writing, or at best the chicken laid four eggs this morning. The other kind of thing happened, man, it was extraordinary. And the ones we've read so far are pretty kind of grim. Let me read you one other postcard just to give you a sense, because that's a very serious story. So some of the funniest stories I've ever written are in here too. For example, this card was, again, just a couple's card, a couple on a bridge kissing. And it's written to Miss M. Brose at 219 Hearst Avenue, San Francisco, California. And it's from Milton. Now, her name's Matilda, as you'll shortly see. But I take Matilda to be Milton's sister. And it's postmarked Sunnyvale, California, July 14th, 1911. And it says, "Dear Matilda, just a line to let you know I am still alive. I am not going on that hayride, the young man that wants me to go with his sister-in-law. But she has a cork leg. I am awful tired. That is the main reason, regards to all, Milton." Now, how can you not be excited about writing the story behind that? Because, of course, in the story, he relents and takes the young woman with the wooden leg on the hayride.
And he has a great time.
He has a great time in unexpected ways.
Yes, yes. And she's a wonderful character. Oh,
thank you. Yeah, I love Minnie.
Oh.
Minnie is her name.
Yeah.
Minnie of the Willow Leg.
Yes.
Because it's not really cork. And Milton finds this out, you know, that it's – in fact, if you think about it, cork's too soft a wood.
Yeah.
In that day, they made a swell wooden leg in the county of Cork in Ireland. And so that's how they started calling them cork legs.
Okay. And Willow is a nice choice for the leg because she's a beautiful girl.
Yes. Needless to say, each of these stories was a special research challenge. And the wonderful serendipity of this and even synchronicity of it is in some bizarre sort of large way reflected in that, for example. By the way, I really was tempted to dedicate this book to Google, because the internet was an extraordinary and actually, I mean this literally, necessary research tool for me to be able to write this book. For example, when I sat down to write The Iron Workers Hayride, within 2 minutes, Google had brought me to a website, which is, believe it or not, woodenleg.com. Where, now remember this card was written in 1911,
right,
where they had the entire text of a 64-page introductory explanatory instructional booklet published in 1909 by the leading wooden leg manufacturer in the United States on wooden legs, where I learned about cork and I learned about willow and I learned how it was that Minnie's leg was in fact attached. And I defy you to walk into any standard library in this country and not go to their internet terminals and find information of that sort.
Yeah. I would imagine that you really enjoy the research
do.
And I think it must help you find the voices that you find when you begin to think about who is Minnie going to be.
Right. That's true. And all 15 stories are written in the first person. And, of course, the DNA of the voice was on the card. And I mean that it's not literal, obviously, but it's an important metaphor. The essence of the character is residing there in those 15 or 20 or 30 words. You can hear Milton. You can hear the narrator of Carl and I in just that those few words. And so these people, once they settled into my unconscious, it took years for me to realize I had a book here. This was simply a collection. But a few years ago, I realized after many years of these voices going into my unconscious and working around there, unknown to me, By the time I was ready to write, those voices were very strong already.
Yeah. What was that eureka moment where you thought, oh, I've got these stories. I'm going to do something. These are speaking to me, and I can have them speak to others.
That was a growing, gradual realization, but the eureka moment was prompted, and this is an interesting story, by a magazine commissioning me to write a short story for them. And this is what actually motivated, didn't have any short stories in mind, but I had been sort of half aware, realizing that someday I might in fact use these postcards. But when this magazine commissioned me to write a short story, and by the way, the commission was simply write us a short story because the magazine is not known for fiction. That's what prompted me to go, well, the only thing I can imagine is maybe some of those postcards are ready to write, because they also wanted a travel angle of some sort. You'll see why in a minute. But with that kind of stricture, the postcards were a natural thing to turn to. So I pulled out a card, the one called No Court of Music. The story is called No Court of Music. And I wrote the story, and it turned out really well. And they ran the story. Now, this – in March – they commissioned me in March of 2001 – and the magazine was Hemispheres Magazine, which is the in-flight magazine of United Airlines. Mm. And they ran this story in the September issue, which means that my story, the first story of this book, was in every seat back, in every seat, in the plane that flew into the South Tower of the World Trade Center and the plane that went down in Pennsylvania.
Mm.
The postcard is a real photo postcard. Someone has taken this with a Brownie camera and printed it on postcards back. And it's a dusty road leading off into a kind of piney wood. And in the foreground is a 1906 Mitchell touring car. And I know it's that because I sent a photocopy of this to the Antique Automobile Club of America. They identified it for me. There are three rows of seats. The front row seat is behind the steering wheel, and that's empty. He's behind the camera. In the second row are two women sitting, one in black, one in white, and they have their arms folded over their chests, and they're smiling at they're looking at the camera. And one of them is the writer of this. I take it to be the woman in black. And it's postmarked Quanah, Texas, November 29th, 1906. It's written to Mrs. Frank Jopes, who I take to be the one in white, 703 17th Avenue North, Seattle, Washington. And she says, "Hello, Mrs. Jopes. Don't this picture recall many pleasant rides over the beautiful driveway?" And then she has written a poem. She has composed a poem and has written it right under the image of the automobile and has signed by CMH, which are her initials. She says, "No chord of music has yet been found to even equal that sweet sound, which to my mind all else surpasses, an auto engine and its puffing gases."
I love that.
Yeah.
Does it surprise you, or did it surprise you that, you know, so often when you write a postcard, even today, or send an email, it's so mundane.
Mm.
But people did record such wonderful things, such intimate expressions as well, and here's something that went through the mail, and mm-hmm. the postman can read it, and you know, if it's yep. lying in the house, somebody can pick it up and read it. I mean, these were all saved.
Yes, yeah, they were saved till the day the recipient died. It was surprising. Some of these went through the mail. I guess they treated their postman like their gynecologist. They just realized thought he was a kind of professional yeah. of sorts, and he looking into everybody, but. But many of them also, like the one on the cover, the one who says he might not live long enough to see her dear face again. In that case, there is no address. He's written across the address thing. Many of these cards were sent by writing on the postcard and then putting it in an envelope and mailing it as if it was a piece of writing paper too. So
yeah.
that was a part of the phenomenon.
Back to the news clippings, the news items, mm-hmm. they are really strange.
They are.
And
very strange. And it makes you think, because it's the New York Times and the New York Sun and so forth and the Herald and the New Orleans Times-Picayune and the L.A. Times. What the thing about newspapers back then is that – and this is why there were two or three dozen in New York City alone – is that they – not only were the newspapers of record, not only did they tell you the main events of the world, but they performed all of the other functions that are now specialized in our media. This is also – they were not only the New York – you know, the strict, you know, careful coverage of the world. They were also the National Enquirer and Entertainment Tonight and Crossfire so it and whatever else, all of the interests, the wide range of interests that people might have in the world, from the mundane and whimsical to the most serious, were these needs were seen as part of the charter of a newspaper.
Yeah, there's a little item that titled "Real Peril," mm-hmm. and it precedes a story, "The One in White." This is such a strange little item, but I mean, you just mentioned, you know, this was the newspaper was the source of entertainment and excitement, and this has to do with what Lieutenant Shackleton's son wanted to hear about from the pages of the newspaper.
He was a great explorer. Shackleton was of the South Pole. By the way, there's an interesting lexicographical note here, because this little item called "Real Peril," in full, it says, "Familiarity with his father's adventures in the search for the South Pole has apparently bred contempt in the mind of Lieutenant Shackleton's small son. He was heard not long ago asking his mother for a story with danger in it. 'I don't want to hear anything more about Papa,' he said. 'Tell me about the baby that was drowned in his barf.'" And that's the entire news item, which appeared in the Daily Tribune of New York on Sunday, August 7th, 1910. Page 3 yet. Oh, well, in section 5. But the interesting thing to me, too, was because I was scrupulous in my researches, I would not use a word in these people's voice that were not words and phrases that were current in that time. And I looked at the word barf, and I said, my goodness, I would have challenged that word in a New York second if I'd been trying to write it in somebody's voice. So I started looking around. Three major dictionaries were of use to me, the Merriam-Webster Dictionary Collegiate, which is the only sort of – well, that's not true anymore. The Random House Unabridged and the Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Dictionary, the only two dictionaries in American English that tell you when the words entered the language. And then, of course, there's the venerable Oxford English Dictionary, which is not just Britishisms. There are a fair number of, you know, they identify American words too. Between those three sources, including the venerable OED, the earliest reference to the word, the earliest entry into the language of the word barf was in the late 1950s.
Really?
So I still have to write the letter, but I've got to tell the OED that they are off by many decades. That because, of course, Shackleton's son did not invent the word.
Right.
It was a word in common usage at the beginning of the 20th
yeah.
century, and no dictionary has yet turned that up. But there it was at the foot
there
of a page in the New York Herald in 1910.
Yeah, it was just it kind of stops you. You know, you just. It's the last word in the little story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this reminds me. I'm old enough to remember when newspapers had lots of items like this in order to fill.
Yeah.
You know, they came to the end of the column. Well, now it's all computerized, so they don't have to worry about it. But there were all kinds of little items like this that were interesting in the newspapers. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, very interesting. The story that follows this, though.
Yeah.
Boy.
Yeah, this is the interesting thing about this book is that, and about those postcards, the things that are on the hearts and minds of the people at the beginning of the 20th century were exactly the same things that are on the hearts and minds of people at the beginning of the 21st century. In stories here, the collision and the conflict between the wealthy and working people, epidemic sickness, war and peace, gender issues, racial issues, hyper-religiosity, the collision of cultures, Christian and Muslim, abortion. And in this book, in this story, for example, quite specifically, let me describe this card. This is another real photo postcard, and we see from behind it is a street in a Mexican town. And we can tell that from the architecture and from the words written on the walls. And the center of the picture is a man who's walking along the street, and the photographer has caught him from behind. But you can tell that he is a gringo. This is an American, a northern from up north. And he's walking along the street, and there are Mexican street fronts, and up in the far ahead is a little gaggle of Mexican people. And he, the guy in the picture, who clearly is the writer of the card, he has drawn an arrow and is pointing it toward one of those tiny figures far up ahead. And on the back, this is the message he's written. After the battle, notice the pretty señoritas in this photo. The one in white does my laundry. Now, the thing I'm leaving out so far is the essence of this image and the essence of the story. And that is that this gringo, this American, is just passing. And in fact, he's not even past them yet. They are barely beyond arm's length, and he is totally ignoring him in the picture, and he totally ignores them. Other than indirectly in that after the battle, he ignores them in a bizarre way in his message as well. What he has just passed are two dead Mexican men sprawled on the sidewalk right next to him in pools of blood. And I took him, therefore, to be a member of the media. He's a newspaper reporter. The battle referred to, what this is an image of Veracruz, Mexico in 1914. And talk about the way in which history repeats itself. In 1914, the United States invaded Mexico and occupied part of Mexico for 7 months in the summer and fall of 1914. And we invaded them over a trumped-up trifle because we did not like the military dictator who was running Mexico and in order to protect American oil interests. Hello. Mm. Yeah, that's so, you know, that's the other thing about the book. The issues of our day were the issues of the beginning of the 20th century as well, even before all of the big troubles of the 20th century began to happen.
Yeah. And we have humanity and inhumanity mm-hmm. here in these stories. There's another battle story, Mother in the Trenches.
Yep.
It's a completely different story.
A bizarre image. And this is a real photo postcard and an extraordinary one. By the way, this story is often heard on NPR. The selected shorts. Those stories where actors read stories out at Symphony Space mm-hmm. in New York. An actress read this last year. This appeared in the story appeared in Story Quarterly, a wonderful Chicago area literary magazine, and then it was picked up in Harper's Magazine and ran there. But it's a real photo image of a middle-aged woman in her gabardine dress with her watch pinned to her chest and a little cloche hat, and she's standing in front of a large pot, which is steaming away and, in fact, has overexposed part of the picture. Mm-hmm. But she and the pot are in the bottom of a World War I trench. You can even see up in the top, in the back, an American service, you know, doughboy or whatever, with his campaign hat on, walking past. And the handwritten message is under the picture, and it simply says, Mother in the Trenches. Some American soldier was drafted and sent to the front lines in France or wherever in 1917. and his mother came to visit him. And that's what this story is in her voice, as she comes to see what she can do for her son.
Yeah, and it's another soldier she
Yeah, ultimately, winds up again, comforting. Twist there mm-hmm. in the story. You know.
Yeah. I want to talk with you about something completely different, or maybe completely different, I don't know. You mentioned Google a moment ago, and somewhere here I have, in the letter that came with the book from Grove, I noticed that you had conducted a project at Florida State where you took your students inside creative writing over the internet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been teaching creative writing for 20 years, and one thing that became kind of ironically persistent in my teaching life was that the primary insight that I give many of my students, have to give them, is that because they aspire to be artists, and the fact is they have been they are so focused on craft and technique that many of them have lost sight of where works of art actually come from. And so I have to remind them, reteach them, or teach them for the first time, many of them, that art does not come from the mind, does not come from the rational analytical faculties. Art comes from the place where you dream, from the unconscious. The irony is that teaching them that is done analytically and through the mind. And what they need to see is the way in which this process works in the moment. Other artists, aspiring artists, are luckier, many of them, because they can see their mentor's work in full. A ballet dancer can watch her mentor rehearse a ballet all the way through to performance. A painter can watch sit quietly mm-hmm. in the back of a studio and watch the painting process, all the paint go up. No one had ever, ever seen the full creative process of a fiction writer. Well, the internet that made that possible for the first time. So under the auspices of the Florida State University website, and it's still archived. I'll give the web address in a minute. But under the auspices of the Florida State University website, on October 30th, 2001, I went onto the internet and for 17 evenings, I wrote a literary short story absolutely from scratch, through to completion, in real time, in full, on the internet. 17 two-hour sessions. And I had cameras set up in my office, and they were able to see, just put on the screen, just my word processor at times. And somebody was down the hall directing, so time, you know, it was an exercise in schizophrenia, to be honest with you, because I would be in the trance of writing from my unconscious, and I'd do something, and part of me would realize that would be useful to explicate, and I'd stop and I'd step out and I'd talk to my virtual audience, explain why I did what I did. And all I had to start with in this was one of these postcards. And what I ended up with 34 hours later, 17 nights later, was a final polished literary story, which is in the book. And you see every comma stroke, all the lousy rotten sentences go up and get reworked, and the whole process. And people who watched live, and there were thousands, many would send email questions to me. I encouraged this, not advice, because that's not how the process goes, but questions about whatever they wanted to know about why I was doing what I was doing. And my grad students sorted through those questions as they came in, and then at the last half hour of each two-hour session, they would bring me questions, and I'd answer questions. Now, this is all still archived at www.fsu.edu/Butler, www.fsu.edu/Butler. But it was a grueling experience, needless to say, but I think very valuable. It fortunately, in spite of the, you know, I did not have a safety net here, but the story turned out really well. It's a good story. I'm glad. Although I was prepared for it to be a lousy story, and then that would have been instructive too. And there's certainly a lot of lousy things go up on the screen and have to get fixed. But even in creating this story, and that's part of the point. It turned out well, and I think people have gotten a lot out of it.
How do you put yourself into that trance and then come back from it?
I don't know. It was kind of schizophrenic. It really was. You know, it was, you know, I, I have learned over the years to turn it on and turn it off. I guess my first four novels, because of the, you know, the exigencies of my private life, I had, oh, if I wanted to be a writer, I could only do it while I was on the Long Island Railroad. This was before laptops. I wrote every word of my first four published novels on my lap on legal pads on the Long Island Railroad. So I, after doing that, I guess I was ready for anything.
Yeah, but still, that's so different. I mean, everybody on the train is in their own little space. They're not being broke.
But on the other hand, too, the virtual audience is not like a real audience. I don't think I could have done it if people were actually sitting there with me, watching me. And that's why it took the internet to be able to do this, because the virtual audience, the way I did it really was, in a sense, I was talking to myself. I was externalizing. And even there, what I said was not analytical stuff. It wasn't lit crit talk. It was more articulating the non-rational process that just took place. So in a way, it wasn't so far out of my trance state, because I was just articulating the non-analytical events. Yeah. It was more like inner dialogue with myself. That's how I took it when I looked at the camera and started speaking about what I had just done.
Well, I really look. I haven't had time to go to the website and look it up, but I look forward to doing that, because I interview writers, you know, regularly, and frequently they're reticent to talk about this process, like somehow it will damage how they do it or something.
Yeah. Well, that's the dangers of teaching, but you have to take that risk for the sake of letting people into the essential knowledge that they must have.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for taking us into these postcards and into your work as a writer.
My pleasure.
Really appreciate it. And anytime you're in town, visiting your friend Philip Graham.
Yes, Philip is an extraordinary treasure here in this town, and he's an amazing writer. And you have a fine MFA program and an extraordinary literary magazine you guys are putting out now too. So Ninth Letter.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Robert Olin Butler has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book, Had a Good Time, Stories from American Postcards, published by Grove Press this evening, October 20th. He'll be at Pages for All Ages in Savoy for a reading and book signing. That is set for 7:30 this evening at Pages. Then tomorrow, you're off to Chicago. And Barbara's Bookstore, 1218 South Halstead. And that event, 7:30 p.m. That's tomorrow, Thursday, October 21st. Again, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And joining me now in the studio is my supervisor, our station manager, Jay Pierce. And Jay joins us this afternoon because we are busy trying to pay for the programs.
That's right.
That we broadcast here on AM 580.
For our ability to bring you guests like Robert, if you had a good time listening this hour, if you learned something, if it inspired you, if it touched you in some way, we'd ask you to call 217-244-9455 and let us know that this programming is valuable to you, and that it's something you care enough about to help help support. As you know, we tell you often enough, about 47% now, almost half of the money that it does take to produce this programming does need to come from you, our listeners. We say that, you know, it'd be mighty easy to take the cheap way out and do a surface interview or flip a switch and run a satellite. There are a lot of options out there. We do things the way we do because we feel it's the right way. And through the years, you have told us it is, and you've been willing to support it. This radio station is, the power is really in your hands to create the radio station that you want when you turn on 580 AM. And we will, our pledge to you, you know, from Celeste, from me, from Martha Deal and Harriet Williamson, the producers of this program, the Afternoon Magazine, our pledge to you is that we will make this radio station as good as you'll help us to with your pledges of support at 217-244-9455. So pick up the phone right now. Make a $5 a month, $5 a month for the interviews that you listen to on the Afternoon Magazine at 217-244-9455. And and help us make the radio station that you want us to be a reality for you in the future.
You're listening, so you value the service.
It's part of the partnership here. This is how public radio operates. You're a listener, and now we want you to be a supporter as well. You're showing us that, yes, by golly, AM 580 is really an important part of my life. I listen to it every day or as often as I can. I listen to it more than any other radio station, and I'm willing to take care of something that I value to make sure. Because the radio station will be here. I mean, there will be something on 580 AM when you turn it on. That's not the question. The question is, how good will it be? You know, how good will it be? What will be there? And will it be something that you enjoy? If this is something you enjoy, call us now, 217-244-9455. You make the difference.
Thanks, Jay. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. Henry Frain is our technical director this afternoon, the producer for the show, Harriet Williamson. And we do hope that you will join us this afternoon with a telephone call to that number, 217-244-9455. And our thanks for Jay for stopping in here on the Afternoon Magazine today and for everyone who has called with a pledge of support. We're going to check in now with Todd Gleason, I believe, to find out what happened today on the Chicago Board of Trade. Todd?
Thanks very much, Celeste. From the Board of Trade this afternoon, beans continuing their move higher from yesterday, at least in the old crop months, the new crop for next year now. We're just a bit lower for the day. On the grain side, the wheat was lower, and so was the corn. Let's begin in the wheat pit, where we do every weekday afternoon when the board is open. December contract, 321 and a quarter the high, the low at 313. Their settlement price at 313.5, and they finished the day 5.75 cents lower. March contract at 332 high, low at 324. Settlement price there at 325, down 4.75. And the May wheat for the day, 335.5 the high, the low at 329.5. A settlement price at 329.75. They were down 4.25. July contract, your harvest month for next year. New crop July at 338.5 on the high, the low at 332. Settlement price for July wheat, 332.25. And they were off 5.5 cents for the day. December corn futures now, 209.5 the high, low at 205.5. A settlement price in the Dease corn down a penny at 206. March futures, 219 the high, the low at 215.5. Settled 216.5, a penny above the low for the day. They were still off a half cent at the end of the day. And the May futures, a 226 high, low at 222.75. Settlement price at 223.25. They were down 0.75 cents. July futures in the corn pit, 232 the high, the low at 228.75. Settled at 229.5, down 0.75 cents in the September contract. 238.75 high, the low at 235.75. Settled at 235.75. They were down 1 cent. New December futures, 247 the high, the low at 244.5. The red Dease settled at 244.75 in a narrow trading range. They were down 0.5 cent at the end of the day. December oats now, 147.75 the high, the low, and settlement price both at 146. Dease oats settled up 0.5 cent in the March futures. A 154.5 high, low at 153.25, settled on that low. They were up 0.75. November beans, 535, rather 534 the high, the low at $5.25, and the November beans settled up 4 cents and 0.75 at 532.5. Once again, November beans, 532.5, the settlement price up 4.75. January beans, 536.5 the high, the low at 528.5, a settlement price at 534.75. They were up 2.5 cents. And the March futures at 541.5 the high, low at 534, settlement price at 538.75. They were up 1. And the May contract, 546.5 the high, the low at 540, settled 544.25. They were up a penny for the day. And July futures at 552 for the high, low at 546, settled 549.5, up a half cent. The August, the only loser that we have for the day to report to you. All the prices there at $5.50. No trade, really, but 550, the settlement price was down 0.5 cent in the August bean contract for next year. By the way, Paul Cooley will be along at 6 after the hour during the closing market report today. He's with ADM Investor Services out of Oakland, Illinois. We'll talk with him about what happened at the Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange, just as we do every Wednesday on the closing market report. December bean meal, 158.50, the high, the low at 156.50. A settlement price there at 158.40. They were up 160 in the January contract, $1.70 higher, 159.80. The settlement price, they had a high of 159.82. Their low at 157.80. December bean oil finished the day 4 cents lower, a 20.92 high, low at 20.49, settled $20.63 a pound, and they were down 4 cents. And the January bean oil, 21.10, the high, the low at 20.65, settled 20.76. They were off 7 cents for the day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. Livestock prices lowered today across the Mercantile Exchange in the contracts that we follow. Feeder cattle, October feeders, the high today, 113.02.5, the low 112.15, the settlement 112.25, that down 115. November feeders, 112.20, the high 110.55, the low finishing at 110.60, that down 170. January 109.60, the high 108.20, the low 108.20, the settlement, that down 150. October live cattle 87.65, the high 86.40, the low 86.50, the settlement, that down 135. December live cattle 88.90, the high 86.70, the low 87, even the settlement, that down 205. December lean hogs, 66.80, the high, 65.80, the low, 65.90, the settlement, that down 60. February, 67.10, the high, 65.80, the low, 66 even, the settlement, that down 90. April, 64.80, the high, 63.90, the low, 64.17.5, the settlement, that down 47.5. May, 65 even, the high, 64.10, the low, 64.95, the settlement, that down 20. February bellies 94.20, the high 92.75, the low 92.80, the settlement, that down 172.5. The Dow is down 43 points at 98.55, the NASDAQ 4 higher at 19.27, the S&P 500 down 2 at 11.01.
Agricultural information is made possible in part by a grant from the Archer Daniels Midland Company. ADM, the nature of what's to come.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Martha Barron from Seattle, Washington wants to know, Dear Dr. Science, on the back side of my computer, there are numerous holes and sockets that have nothing plugged into them. What is their function and purpose?
Those are air vents to rid the computer of excess silicon monoxide, a poisonous gas produced as a product of computing. Unless you're doing a lot of number crunching, the gas won't build up to a sufficient concentration to kill you, although breathing even a microscopic amount may encourage you to become morbidly preoccupied with past humiliations, failed relationships, and to find yourself revolting when you look in the mirror. You can plug those holes with silica gel if you wish to avoid such brooding, or you could stick straws into them and point them toward your face, if that's your idea of a good time.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath. To order the Dr. Science book kit with the Dr. Science book of shocking domestic revelations, best of series.